You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso and espresso and cream flavors. I had one this morning before I came into the studio, and let me tell you, it gave me just the boost I needed to get my day going. Plus, it tastes so delicious, I'd drink it anyway. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. You know Paul Lieberstein from his memorable role as Toby Flenderson on The Office, the hit TV show on which he not only acted, but directed, wrote, and for 4 of its 9 seasons served as showrunner. But what you might not know about the mild-mannered Lieberstein is that for 20 years he suffered from debilitating back pain that was at times so excruciating that some days he couldn't move at all. But then, a decade ago, he went through a major transition in his life when he realized that his back pain was psychological in origin and tied to his lifelong suppression of anger. The man who never yelled once before the age of 40 decided to totally rethink how he dealt with his emotions, and the backaches that many doctors said would require surgery miraculously vanished. The experience was so surprising and significant for Paul Lieberstein that it inspired him to write, direct, and star in a new film titled Song of Back and Neck. The film is Paul's directorial debut and was nominated for Best Narrative Feature at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. And today, Paul Lieberstein joins me on the podcast to talk about his own struggle with back pain and how he turned it into a funny and at times magical motion picture. He talks about his crippling affliction that plagued him for years, including when he was making The Office, his original skepticism of New Age healing, and his utter amazement when he discovered it really was all in his head. He shares how the king of indie filmmaking, Mark Duplass, convinced him to make the movie himself rather than selling it to a Hollywood studio, how he made something as seemingly mundane as back pain visually compelling on the screen, and the complications and conflicts of interest that can arise when you're directing yourself. We talk about his 9 seasons playing Toby on The Office, what it was like to do double duty as an actor and a showrunner. He reveals that during the first season, NBC initially didn't think the show would last more than a few episodes and weighs in on recent talk of an Office revival. Plus, he addresses how The Office's Michael Scott might fare in the age of Me Too, whether there was more to Michael Scott's visceral hatred for Toby, and favorite fan theories, including one that suggests that Toby was secretly the Scranton killer. Coming up with Paul Lieberstein in just a moment. Paul Lieberstein is a writer, director, producer, and actor best known for his work on The Office. He played Toby Flenderson as well as wrote on the show all 9 seasons and served as executive producer and showrunner for seasons 5 through 8. He was co-showrunner with Aaron Sorkin on the final season of The Newsroom, where he also wrote, directed, and acted. Other series include King of the Hill, The Drew Carey Show, and The Bernie Mac Show. And he directed his first feature film, which he also wrote and stars in. It's called Song of Back and Neck, which is available on video on demand. Paul Lieberstein, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I was thinking about you this morning because I read some headline on my Apple News feed that Steve Carell said emphatically that he has no interest in doing a revival of The Office. And I was like, why does he need to make that statement? Because I keep hearing all this talk of a revival of The Office, but I don't know where it's coming from. Is anyone associated with The Office seriously talking about doing something new with it? It comes up a lot.
Yeah, I think, you know, NBC recently came around to wanting it again.
Oh, okay.
You know, it took them a while to kind of recognize that maybe they had a good thing there.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, you know, I think they just kind of renewed the rights. I really don't know much about the story, but they would certainly like to do it. And, you know, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that so many of the sitcoms are being given a revival.
Yeah, but that's like 20 years later.
It's 20 years later, yeah. I have, I'm not surprised at all that Steve doesn't want to do it. He's doing like really interesting work now, you know. And you know what? Most of the cast has moved on as well. I mean, I can't imagine people are available.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the fans would love it, but I also have to think that The Office would be a very different show in the Me Too era. I mean, your character, especially Toby, you would probably be spending half the episode on paperwork.
I would have a little more to say, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Could be good for you.
Yeah, but you know, the Me Too era, I don't know how hard it's hit other industries. I really don't. You know, it's taken down entertainment for sure.
Yeah.
But it sure hasn't made a dent in politics.
Yeah, that's for sure.
In fact, we've really gone the other way.
Well, it depends on who the politician is. Like, if you're Al Franken, then it'll doom your career. But there is one certain politician who has immunities reason. I don't know why.
But it really seems to be any politician who decides they want to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, I'll step down.
Deny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're willing to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly impacted tech. I mean, there have been a number of tech CEOs who have had to step down and so forth.
Yeah, boards are making people a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. Aware. Now, when you first came on.
A little paper company? I don't know.
A little paper company.
I don't know.
maybe there's a YouTube or a Funny or Die video in there somewhere. when you first came to The Office, were you brought on as a writer and an actor? Because I don't think a lot of people know that you were also a showrunner on the show and were a writer. You directed episodes.
Yeah, I started there as a writer. And,
okay.
I had never acted before, so there was really no intention of doing that. We had, you know, pre-production, but I was on from season one. And then Greg Daniels, who was the executive producer and the guy in charge of adapting it, and he ran it for first four seasons and came back for the last. He had this idea of letting the writers kind of experience what it was like to be on set. And he kind of promoted a lot more just dialogue between the writers and the actors, thinking maybe this could be an interesting thing. And, you know, there's really kind of a very heavy wall that for some reason has been developed between writers and actors on TV shows. And you're really not supposed to even talk about the show.
Yeah.
You know, you can chat, you can get friendly, but if you have something, you should go through the executive producer or if it's on set, the director.
I know shows where the writer's room and the actors never interact.
They never interact. And you know, I really think that it's kind of a fear. There's two things. One, I guess there's because I've also directed a lot, I know that you can build a performance kind of carefully, and one wrong note, if somebody else gave a wrong note, can send an actor off in the wrong direction and it kind of brings them back. I think there is a creative reason to kind of, especially on set, to funnel everything through one person.
Mm-hmm.
and make sure, you know, I've been on set where an actor's getting notes from three different places and they can flex. Yeah. And it's like, what the hell,
yeah.
you know, what I'm supposed to do. But at the same time, I think that this wall is there more for people to kind of consolidate power. You know, some mm-hmm. people just don't want, are just threatened by.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So Greg, not being a guy who's threatened by things like that, decided, hey, what's going to be like to kind of rip down this wall and promote? And the result was amazing.
Yeah, and it wasn't just you. I mean, there were a lot of writers who were also actors. And, of course, Phyllis famously started out as, I think, the casting director.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
yeah. But then yeah. just even the conversation that there was this fluid mm-hmm. flow of ideas that included the writers and the actors together.
Yeah, yeah.
I think made it a better show.
It's interesting because when you were talking about, you know, getting notes from all these different places, it made me think of something that I heard John Krasinski once say about the first season, which is that it was so pessimistic behind the scenes because he claims that like all the NBC people were constantly coming in and saying, this is only going to be one season. This is going to be the last episode. Were they really that negative on the show that first round?
You know, nobody comes in and says it's going to be canceled. But at the same time, people were really not sticking their neck out for this show.
Mm-hmm.
They're really, I mean, when we finished the first six, everybody like hugged and said goodbye and like with a real feeling like that was it.
Really?
And plus, we were doing something that, you know, and didn't really have a place on, not that I say it didn't have a place on NBC. It didn't have a, there was nothing on NBC that would like lead you to believe that this was going to work there.
Yeah.
But Kevin Reilly saw it and he was the true champion of The Office at NBC. But when we came back, we were back for six episodes and then we were picked up for three episodes and then we were picked up for two episodes and then we were picked up for the remainder of season two. But they were not sticking their, nobody was sticking yeah. their neck out for the show. We were really on the brink of being canceled.
Really?
When iTunes just started.
I heard that.
So the yeah, timing was like, we were the first show that was selling well on iTunes. We were promoted. We were like, because of
that,
we made like, if you bought a little iPod at the time, I mean, you couldn't even do it on your phone, but if you bought this iPod, you'd have a picture of The Office, you know, embedded in the little screen on the box.
Okay.
You know, and
so they were heavily promoting you.
They were
more than the network was. Probably.
More than the network was because we were being, yeah. And I think the network finally saw that and said, oh, wait, there's definitely another income stream and maybe there's something here that we didn't notice.
Yeah. And it's funny that was the thing that did it for you guys because, I mean, you were already on television for free. It's not like this was some cable show on AMC that people, you know, if they didn't have a subscription, could only access on the phone. Yeah, the people already had access.
Yeah, they had access.
Yeah. Now, in those first few seasons, you guys stuck, for, or at least the first season, you stuck fairly closely to the original format of the British version.
Not exactly.
No.
Really, just the first episode.
Okay. Okay. But the conceit that it was all a documentary and there was a crew that was kind of shadowing everyone at Dunder Mifflin
that
was
stayed
there.
Through all nine seasons.
Right. But it seems to me that they did kind of dial it back over time. And it was just kind of one of those things that faded into the background, except on very rare occasions you might have some kind of breaking the fourth wall type thing where you actually see the crew.
It's right, like in a right. In season nine, they like started to break the fourth wall. But actually, at least from my point of view, from the inside, we had some very strict rules about what it was like to be in a documentary.
Really?
And characters' awareness. I think one of the things that you might have noticed, and this is something we talked about and did on purpose, was that through time, if a documentary crew was following you around, 4 years into being followed around, you're pretty familiar with them.
Right.
You're not so freaked out. You don't notice them quite as much.
Right.
You probably consider them your friend, you know.
Yeah. And I forget that you always had the interviews, even in the very last seasons. You still had the on-camera interviews they were doing. But it almost seems so seamless that you forget about it.
We would never like be in a place where the doc crew wouldn't be loud. We would never in someone's bedroom.
Right.
There was never that we had things called spy shots where if we wanted to,
right.
if we wanted to have people aware, kinda, yeah, but yeah. we would really pull back the camera,
mm-hmm.
put an obstacle between us, you know, and really try to
yeah.
get across the fact that these people were in private and would act a little differently.
Yeah, that's true. Now, what was behind the intense dislike between Michael Scott and your character, Toby? Because what I don't understand is that was there from the very beginning, from season one. And I don't know if it's just that he was a guy who didn't like a lot of rules and you were the HR guy, or if there was more to it, because it was just an incredibly visceral dislike. Is
it
that
was
just
a visceral
mystery for the ages or what?
It was, you know, it's not that it wasn't embedded in the script, but I think it was definitely something found on set.
Okay.
In Steve's side that, so there was an episode we did. We filmed it fairly early on. I can't remember what order it was exactly, but it was Meredith's birthday card. And he just couldn't think of something to sign. He spent the whole episode trying to think, you know, what's the perfect funny thing to write in her card. And I just go into his office and say, do you have the card? And I just fill it out. and say thanks and leave. And then you just kind of see him staring at me. And in that moment, it, you know, I really did write in the card and it really did take like 30 seconds. And he told me that he was, in that time he would just, felt himself just well up with hate towards my character. And I think it really informed a lot of everything that yeah. we did after that.
Because it was just so easy for your character. Because
he would criticize a lot of people all the time, but there was hate
mm-hmm.
when it came to my character. I think that my character was yeah. just one that, you know, was not emotional.
Yeah.
And his character only dealt on an emotional level.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, yeah. Now, I have to imagine there are probably all kinds of fan theories around a show that lasted that long. Do you have a favorite?
Fan theories?
Yeah.
Or conspiracy theories. I love that I'm theories, the, yes, that I'm the Grand Strangler. I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It took a lot of a lot of internet data. Yeah, there's a lot of gigabytes going to that.
How much of that was improvised versus scripted?
Oh, the Grand Strangler stuff?
Oh, well, just everything.
Oh. The vast majority of it was scripted.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. There was every once in a while there was just a brilliant improvised line that would make it through. But often, even though people would maybe say something that was maybe even a little bit funnier than the line that was written, it, you know, the line also had to like serve a story purpose and feed mm-hmm. the next person to say this. And
right.
it, you know, there was kind of a complicated chain of events. So
yeah. So not a lot of people like, went off script.
No, they would do it a lot in the beginning, and that when they saw started to see the episodes where it was mostly on script, they did it less. But that's not to say that like they didn't find a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, you know, when he saw an opportunity, he sees, and he's so fast.
Yeah. Now, when you took over as showrunner for those four seasons. Did that change your dynamic with the cast or because everything was kind of fluid behind and in front of the camera, did it make that transition, I guess, a little bit more comfortable?
It was pretty comfortable. Mm-hmm. I had a really good relationship with everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like, all the cast was scratching their heads. Like what's the new guy like,
yeah.
you know, they knew exactly. me and they knew my scripts. And,
yeah. yeah. Nobody was like, they picked Paul.
Right. Or maybe they were, but they didn't say that to me.
We're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back with more with Paul Lieberstein when we come back in just a minute. This episode of Kick-Ass News is sponsored by the audiobook edition of Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal, written and read by Senator Ben Sasse. Something is wrong in America, and we all know it. In this intimate and urgent assessment of our country, best-selling author and U.S. Senator Ben Sasse argues that the crisis isn't really about politics at all. It's about loneliness and the collapse of community. If you listened to my recent interview with Senator Ben Sasse, then you already heard me rave about them. This is a timely and relevant audiobook, and you can hear this compelling audiobook in the author's own voice. Take it with you in the car or around the house. Listen to an excerpt and buy the audiobook now by visiting macmillanaudio.com/them. That's macmillanaudio.com/them. Today's episode is sponsored by Zeal. I was a fan of Zeal long before they even became a sponsor on the show, so I'm very happy to talk about them today. Zeal is an amazing service that offers professional in-home massages at your door in an hour. After a long day at work or a tense holiday weekend, Zeal is the perfect way to de-stress. With Zeal, you get a professional massage in the privacy of your own home, so you don't have to go all the way to the spa or sit around with a bunch of strangers at the gym. Just open the Zeal app and choose your favorite massage style. You can pick from Swedish, deep tissue, sports, prenatal, or sleep massage. An hour later, a licensed massage therapist shows up at your door. They even bring their own massage table. It's just like the spa comes to you. The best part is, tip is included, so you don't have to dig around for cash when you're done. Just rinse off in your own shower and get back to your day, or go straight to bed. I already told you that I use Zeal and I'm a big fan. Sometimes after a workout or sitting at a desk all day, my back gets stiff and I can really use a massage, but the last thing that I want to do is deal with going to the spa and the check-in, the locker room, the payment, and then driving home. All that stuff just kills what ought to be a relaxing experience. But with Zeal, a massage therapist comes right to my door. They're always very professional. They bring all the nice spa stuff, the oils, the table, the sheets, even the relaxing spa music. And the best part is, when they're done, they leave, and you can do whatever you want. You've really got to give Zeal a try. Download the Zeal app and use the promo code KICK for $25 off your first massage. That's Zeal, Z-E-E-L, and promo code KICK. Zeal, wellness on the way. Use your sports and pop culture knowledge to make some extra cash this week with BetDSI. BetDSI.com has been paying winners for 20 years. With a really user-friendly interface and mobile site and the fastest payouts in the industry, it's no wonder BetDSI is top-rated on betting review sites. Simply play, win, and get paid. BetDSI offers betting options for everything from NFL, NCAA football, NBA, NHL, UFC, and all other major sports, to politics, reality TV, esports, virtually everything. There's also live betting, which lets you bet on games through the entire matchup, every play and every minute until the end. Try for yourself. New members get 100% bonus match using promo code KICK. That's more than double your money to start winning today. Just go to BetDSI.com and use promo code KICK to get this limited-time 100% bonus offer and make some extra cash on the sports you know and love. It's only a game until you bet it at BetDSI. And now, back to the podcast. Now, you've got this great new movie, Song of Back and Neck,
yeah,
which you wrote, directed, produced, and starred in. When you embarked on this project, did you feel like your experience on The Office prepared you to helm a feature film, or was there a little bit of a rude awakening at some point in the process?
No, definitely. You know, of course, running that thing was great training. But at the same time, I don't think I realized just quite how heavily I was supported in television. Compared to independent film, which is just, wow, you're really on your own.
Right. You got a writer's room that's got your back.
Yeah.
You got the network to deal with, which is a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, there's a ton of people to deal with and extremely collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into film, it's just, you want to do it, so you just do it. You want to make a change on the day, you just change.
Yeah. I mean, on some level, it must have been liberating to
go from having notes
from the network and all that.
It's terrifying, you know, too.
I'm a guy with a computer. I'm going to bang this thing out, and then I'm going to decide just to go indie and do it myself.
Just to do it, yeah. I couldn't believe when I learned that existed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like when I wrote it, I didn't even know that the whole indie – I didn't know anything about making a movie.
Yeah.
And then just – I had this friend, Mark Duplass.
I had him on the show. He's great.
He's great.
I mean, that's Mr. Indie.
Mr. Indie. Yeah, and we were talking, and he just kind of like laid it out for me, like, here's some ways to just make your movie. I thought, oh my God, I can just do it. And we did it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Right. Now, I mean, what was the budget? I'm assuming that you did it on fairly tight budget.
Yeah. It was low budget.
Mm-hmm. At one point, did you ever consider that you were going to just, say, sell the script or maybe write and direct and let it be a studio film, be a $5, $10 million movie?
I think that was my assumption going in because mm-hmm. I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, that you could. But I think what I, when I finished it and started to look around and then took us a look at what was being released and what that was like,
yeah.
I kind of realized, oh, this is not what people make. You know, it's not a genre thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They're still making lots of kinds of movies, but they all really fit into genre mm-hmm. if they're getting wide release.
Right. And I mean, you can make a $1 million movie and star in it yourself, or you can make a $21 million movie and get Tom Cruise.
Right. You can do it right. But yeah. this movie at $21 million with Tom Cruise still doesn't fit into a marketable genre like that. So it hit. I don't think there was a way that this was going to mm-hmm. open in 3,000 theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So it really did fit the indie world much better. And you know, we're downloadable now.
And the environment
and I think that's
now
how
suits
people
that.
Are going to watch this kind of movie.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's a lot easier to be an indie filmmaker today than it was 10, 20 years ago, or, you know, at the heyday of Miramax or the Weinstein Company and those.
Right.
Guys,
there was a few gatekeepers back there.
Yeah.
And if it didn't pass that, but now, you know,
we're out goes.
There. We made it and we're out there. It's great.
I loved it. Tonally, it reminds me a lot of Charlie Kaufman's movies because it mixes the realism with the uncanny and a certain sense of wonder. Was he one of your inspirations?
Yeah, no doubt.
What other directors or films did you draw on?
Yeah, I definitely looked at his stuff. I loved his tone, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, his movies are just terrific. And visually tried to kind of capture, you know, some of the Coen brothers' work.
Mm-hmm.
Although I found that to be really hard with this budget, but and then some of the older movies too, like Hal Ashby movies.
Oh, really? Yeah.
The Graduate I watched probably mm-hmm. a bunch of times right before filming.
Yeah.
Because I just love that composition.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of the first dry comedy. I don't know what preceded The Graduate in terms of something that kind of had that same tone.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie was perfect.
Now, when you wrote it, did you think that you were also going to star as well? Did you write this part
for
yourself?
No. I mean, I knew it was definitely something I could do,
mm-hmm.
but no, and again, it goes back to just ignorance of what was going on in film at the time. But, you know, I assumed that this would be a normal movie with a normal, studio, you know, actor.
Yeah. Now, did the part change much when you decided that you were going to be the star?
The part didn't change much, no.
No.
You know, I just definitely did a rewrite mm-hmm. for take away some of the most expensive parts. But
Okay. So you rewrote it as a director from the perspective of the director.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or producer, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm always impressed with artists who can simultaneously do the behind the camera and the in front of the camera at the same time. What is the hardest part of directing and starring?
Well, there's this, you know, it's all about the adjustment. You can plan mm-hmm. and plan and plan. And if everything went perfectly, it wouldn't be any problem.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there's a time consuming element to taking a look at what you did, thinking about it, trying to step away from maybe your own ego. And because mm-hmm. you're seeing, watching yourself.
Yeah.
And making these adjustments and, you know, trying to figure out what's not working or what could be better.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes harder when doing both.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, because how do you separate your goals as a director from your goal as an actor?
Yeah.
They're not always mutually aligned.
I guess not. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think I probably saved some time and just knowing what I wanted,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
I didn't have to.
Did you come pretty prepared? Did you have a shot list? You have
storyboards,
all that?
Yeah, we knew. I mean, they were just my own scratch storyboards.
Oh, yeah.
They were awful, you know. You know, they don't have eyes on them or anything.
Well, but, I don't want to give away too much about the movie, but elements of this movie are semi-autobiographical or inspired by your own experience. As the title would suggest, the main character suffers from severe debilitating back and neck pain.
Yep.
This is something that you struggled with for how many years?
It sure is, like 15 at least.
Wow.
And I had it bad, and there were just days where I just was lying on the floor and couldn't get up, or something would happen, and all of a sudden I couldn't get out of my chair, and I didn't know why.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, my back just kind of seized up on me. And then, you know, 15 years later to read this book by the guy, by this Dr. John Sarno, who...
Tell us
and realize you know, psychologically based. It was coming from me, and it was kind of rooted in a suppression of anger.
Interesting.
Which is a little, wow. You know, feels a little like mind-body hocus-pocus kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm generally skeptical of that
I'm
sort of thing.
Extremely skeptical.
Really?
And I had been so skeptical my whole life, so that was, it was such a giant transformation for me.
Yeah.
To just like, you know, I had to throw all that stuff out the window too, because now I just know it's true.
Yeah. Now, how does that work? Because, you know, I know in the movie, your character is being told by a doctor that he has sciatica and he has a slipped disc and all of these physical symptoms. How do you explain that with the whole mind-body thing then? If you're diagnosing physical ailments, how do you explain what's going
it's
on
true. Well,
mentally?
You know, So there's a leap that this guy makes, and I think that's like why it's taken so long for the medical establishment to accept him.
Yeah. But,
so the leap that he makes is your body is sending these signals to your muscles to contract really quickly, and it mimics the three most prevalent forms of back pain,
really?
Which are pinched nerve in the neck and sciatica and then kind of like a slip disc. Kind of a
okay. Wow.
But what you find with this kind of pain is that it might switch to another. So at one point I had a doctor tell me to operate on a pinched nerve, but at another point I was going down for lower back pain and my neck was fine. And then
it's like whack-a-mole.
It also
to figure
it's
out
like,
where it is.
Why was it terrible one day, but then 3 weeks later I was running,
yeah.
And then it's bad again a month later.
Huh.
Like, there's something, and that's the form of so many people's pain. Is that it just comes and goes over years? There had to be something else. So, the leap that he makes is that your body is your mind is sending this to create back pain so that you think about the back pain instead of thinking about something else.
Okay.
That your body is like unwilling.
Yeah.
That your brain is unwilling to look at.
Okay.
And you know, there's this like tons of support psychologically in Jung's shadow, you know, that there's a lot of human nature that we don't want to acknowledge. It all makes perfect sense. And the mind is connected to our body.
It's
physically
especially
connected
to the spine. It's all part of the
electrical
system. Right.
It's all so clearly like we can, it's our brain telling our hands to pick up a glass of water. But for some reason, it's, you know, logical thought. We all accept that, but the kind of connection that an emotion is also connected to our body, we then throw that into New Age thinking.
Interesting.
But there isn't really a reason that we do that.
That's fascinating.
I don't know. I've totally been turned around as a guy who's
that is
just
incredible.
100% skeptic to now believing, all that stuff really is true. I mean,
and
you know,
had tried everything else, right?
I have tried everything. I saw from the head of orthopedics at UCLA to, you know, massage therapists and physical therapists and chiropractors and
even
acupuncture.
I mean, I've had times when I've had back pain. I've had a couple of times in my life when I've thrown out my back or whatever you want to call it, where I had to just lay down for several days because, you know, I couldn't hold myself up straight.
Really?
So I can certainly empathize, but I can imagine 15 years of that.
15 years of on and off. Wow. Yeah.
My God.
It wouldn't be every day, but
yeah. And this was when you were doing The Office as well? Because that's got to be pretty demanding.
It was certainly the beginning of The Office.
Wow. And in the movie, your character sees an acupuncturist. I hate needles, so I've always been afraid of that. Did that work for you as well?
Or? No, of course it didn't work.
Oh, didn't?
I actually don't think it works. Mm-hmm. I think it's, a placebo effect.
Yeah. It never made logical sense to me.
It's almost impossible to.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to do a study.
So at what point when you were dealing with back pain did it dawn on you that maybe this could be a good idea for a movie?
It was such a thing I was thinking about a lot. Mm-hmm. And I also think character in transition is a good basis for a movie.
Yeah.
And then when it comes with that transition is like fueled by a realization, you know, that kind of betters a character's life. It's just the elements were lining up.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So was it after you had kind of overcome this? Was that when really start to flesh out for you?
Yeah.
The idea?
Yeah. After, I mean, it was such a giant thing.
Yeah.
It's like for years I've been doing that to myself that it was just a topic.
Yeah.
You know.
Back pain would seem like that would be a pretty mundane thing to depict on film. I mean, I've thrown my back out and, you know, the way I dealt with it was literally by doing nothing. So,
right.
That must have been kind of a hurdle as a director from the get-go to figure out how do you depict that sort of thing.
Well, that's one of the reasons the acupuncture has that element.
Right, right.
It's magical realism element to it.
Yeah, and I love the opening scene of the movie because we see your character on the floor on his back after he wakes up and he's sliding through his morning ritual from the shower to brushing his teeth, eating cereal.
I'm
guessing he's probably skipped the bathroom that morning.
That would have been.
But that's what it feels like, you know? It's like, how can I function but stay in the exact same position that I'm in?
Right.
It's really incredible. Yeah, the opening scene is probably one of my favorite parts to it. How did you come up with that?
I just kind of wanted to show that this was a guy living with it.
Yeah.
You know, like this was the stasis. You know, if it was a new thing, you kind of waited out, but
it was pretty
hilarious. That prevalent. You got to go on with your day. You
know? And I understand that you actually worked in your dad's law office at one point before you went into entertainment, just like your character, Fred. Was that a pretty soul crushing experience like it is in the movie?
No, not at all.
No,
I worked part time while I was writing scripts.
Okay. Oh, really?
I liked it. It was, you know.
Did Dad ever want you to go into the family business?
Oh, he did.
Oh, yeah.
I think so. Yeah, but it wasn't in the cards.
Yeah, it's funny because I've met a number of people over the years who originally went pre law or went to law school and then somehow end up in the entertainment industry, and I don't know why that is, but.
It's not for everyone.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
Does my father was a patent lawyer, which is a very specific type, and I really would have had to go for it from early on because you need a science background as well as a law background.
Now, again, I don't want to give away too much about this film, but music also plays a big role in the movie. In some ways, it's a character of its own, and it's a brilliant device for illustrating, you know, your inner emotional pain and the changes that your character goes through. How did you come up with that?
I can't remember the exact germ.
Yeah.
But, to go on something you were just pointing out a minute ago, that it was, I can't just have someone lying in back pain and nothing happens. And it needs some kind of manifestation of the pain and in an action. And I also wanted to kind of put a different face on the pain because it was something that was like kind of amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a brilliant solution to that problem.
Yeah.
How do you depict that sort of thing?
Thanks.
Yeah. Who did the music?
Antonio Andrade.
Okay.
Who, is great, young composer. He works with, Hans Zimmer.
Oh, wow.
And this is one of the first that he just done on his own.
Yeah.
Not the first.
Yeah, terrific job.
But he's done, he did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
But he's worked on some giant movies, but just not the composer in name.
Yeah, because music plays so heavily into this film. That's a big responsibility.
It really did. And there were so many early cuts there. I was like, oh my God, this is working. The music just didn't.
Yeah. Well, because when you were shooting and editing this, you probably didn't have the music yet. So you didn't know that.
And I didn't even have a
concept
of it.
You didn't know what you were going to have.
Yeah. I just wrote in the script that this is like, it was producing a sound that was like somewhere between a beautiful whale song and a Icelandic New Age band.
I love that. That's spot on.
But I didn't have I didn't know what it was going to be until it was created.
Yeah, it's just such a wonderful, unique movie. What's next? Are you doing more films or TV?
I'm developing a couple TV shows, and I'm working on another, writing my next film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
About some other ailment, or
it's not about an ailment. It's about the shadows department at a university, based on a short story.
Department at a university. Yeah. What is the shadows?
It's
department?
Not a real thing, but umbrology, okay. Study of shadows.
Oh, okay, okay. Cool.
And interesting. Follows a professor and kind of turns into a little bit of a murder mystery.
Oh, cool.
It's been fun.
I like it.
It's out of my wheelhouse, but I'm loving
now,
it.
Do you think that you might star in that too?
I think I'm going to try to pull back and maybe I'll play a small role.
But. Yeah. Well, once again, Paul Lieberstein's film is called Song of Back and Neck. It's available now on video on demand. Paul, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks again to Paul Lieberstein for coming on the podcast. Definitely watch his new film, Song of Back and Neck, now available on video on demand. And follow Paul on Twitter at Paul Lieberstein. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. I had one today and it gave me just the shot in the arm I needed. Plus, it tastes so good, I'd drink it anyway. That's because Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.